Now we come to our guest of the night. Everyone came here really to listen to Ramsey Clark's take on 15 years of endless war and the new threats on Iran and why. Why? Because I think everyone here knows that Ramsey Clark has never been an armchair analyst. Every U.S. war, every attempt at regime change on the front lines and at risk and danger, Ramsey Clark found a way to actually be there. And that includes in Iraq during the height of the U.S. bombing in 91 and every year during the sanctions when the media throughout the world said not a word as a great crime was underway. And if the leadership of any country, when the media, when the propaganda is all out in demonizing that leadership, making them a target of regime change, a way of making the issues understood, Ramsey Clark has spoken out very courageously at the times when it's the most difficult, the most difficult. And I don't think we could think of any war, intervention, invasion, sabotage, attack in the past 35 years that has come from the U.S. war machine that Ramsey Clark wasn't leading the challenge. So please join me in welcoming Ramsey Clark.
Well, it's wonderful to feel your spirit. God knows we need it. And it's always a privilege and a joy to be able to work with people like Sarah and Larry and Teresa and so many who commit their lives to peace and justice. We're on the brink of either disaster or fundamental change. And the choice is ours, not just the people in this room, but if, as I believe, life is choice, it's up to the people to choose. And as grim as things are, I can't remember a time when the conditions of government and business and social values in the country have been as corrupt and immoral and harmful to children as they are right now. And still, I believe we shall overcome. In September of 1973, I went down to Chile, 3 or 4 days after the golpe. I'd gotten literally scores of telephone calls, and all of them focused on a large number of Air Force personnel had been arrested by the new junta, of which Pinochet was only one of four, because all the military services, including the Carabinieri, the police, joined in. It was armed might against the people. They put all the junior officers in the Carcel Publico, and I spent a couple of days with them. I didn't get to see the general. And when I went back for the trials of the Air Force people, they were charged with doing exactly what the junta did, and that is overthrow the government, which is typical of the tricks that governments play on people's minds and why we have to hang on to our thinking. It's our greatest risk is we don't think enough about what's being said and done. But the general was dead. He died in March of 74 from torture and abuse. His daughter was 20, she and her mother. The other two kids had fled the country, were also arrested, tortured. The daughter studied and worked, became a doctor, a pediatrician, fled the country, went to East Germany. When she came back, she couldn't get a job because of who she was for a long time. She worked with a Swedish NGO, dealing with what she cared about the most, I think, children, as a pediatrician. But imagine now the people of Chile liberating themselves sufficiently to elect a woman who had so many happenings in her life that would make it impossible, you'd think, to ever be elected. She was divorced. You couldn't get a divorce in Chile legally until 2 years ago. She was divorced long before that, but not in Chile. Child out of wedlock. An avowed agnostic in a country that's as conservatively Catholic as any in the Western Hemisphere. But a woman of great charm and conviction, and solidly elected over a multi-millionaire businessman with the full support of the people. I think we have Argentina on the right side. People were doubtful until the Mar del Plata meeting, but his conduct there convinced me absolutely that he understands the problem. He knows how Latin America has been exploited by the United States. He could count 70 of the interventions himself, said so, by U.S. Marines and other branches of our military in the Western Hemisphere. We've got a great opportunity in Brazil. Brazil is so big and so complicated and so difficult, but we have brilliant leadership there. Absolutely thrilling leadership from Bolivia. Whenever I see a full-blooded indigenous elected to office, I say, hallelujah. I think of one of the greatest presidents that ever presided over any country in this hemisphere, who was a full-blooded Zapotec Indian. Had no right to believe he'd live to be 25 years old. Had a 50-50 chance at birth of living 3 years. That was the infant and child mortality. And yet he became twice the president of Mexico, Benito Juarez. And Mexico's gift to the United Nations, which is a great big hunk of lava rock, just outside the General Assembly, has inscribed on it, I'll give you the English version, this saying from the many wise sayings of Benito Juarez: a respect for the rights of others is peace. And I think that's the key to the whole problem. If we would respect the rights of the Iranians, we'd have peace. If we'd respect the rights of the Iraqis, we'd have peace. If we'd respect the rights of the American Indians and the African Americans, the descendants of slaves, and the Mexican-American and Latin-American struggling for economic opportunity and freedom, and sending money back to feed hungry people and family members wherever they came from, we'd have peace. When we stop our interventions, we'll have peace. There's nothing that is more violative of the rights of others, not just military interventions, but economic interventions and cultural interventions, perhaps the most damaging, finally, of all. We have to believe that if we really work at it, we can do it. I frankly think that Bush is on the ropes. We ought to remember that a lot of people have gotten off the ropes. We can't let him off the ropes. I'll say a few things about Iraq, but before I do, I want to echo Larry on Martin Luther King. Several times, but particularly I remember vividly on the first night of the march from Selma to Montgomery, I'd been sent down to protect the marchers. I had about 500 military police, and I had about 2,000 soldiers. I had to call the White House to get the Department of Defense to tell them to do what I said, because they wouldn't. Aside from that, we stopped in Lowndes County. We'd have an agreement with the farmer. We could stay on his property, and he got threatened and revoked the agreement. We had to find a place just off the road. There were only 50 marchers allowed to march in this great and free society under court order from Selma to Montgomery. Nobody in their right mind marches from Selma to Montgomery unless they have to do something awfully important when they get there. And all they wanted was the dangerous right to vote. In Mississippi in 1964, 6.7% of the African-American population of voting age was registered to vote. It was darn dangerous to do it, I'll tell you. But by 1968, because of the March from Selma to Montgomery, more than 70% of the African-American population was registered to vote. Change can come, and so can reversal. And we're in a constant struggle to go forward. But that night, Lowndes County's famous down there. Its motto is, "Don't let the sun go down on you in Lowndes County, Digger." And they meant it. And the fear was palpable. I really felt like we built bonfires and had sentries marching back and forth to protect 50 marchers. And they were intense. Dr. King was talking with a few, and his message was, "Never be afraid, because you will hate the cause of your fear, and your own hatred will destroy your soul." He was absolutely right. We have to apply that to 9/11. I mean, what cowards we've appeared to be. Absolute fear. We do outstandingly immoral and outrageous and harmful things, harmful to ourselves. We have acted in the most effective way that could have been devised to create what we call terrorism by our conduct. People don't like to be bombed, you know, they really don't. And you bomb them long enough and they'll come after you. And we have to learn that. We have to set aside fear and do what we have to do. And not just physical fear, perhaps above all, the fear of not being approved by our peers. You got to stand up and do it when you know it's right. It's about lying, and everybody wants to indict somebody for lying, and some even want to impeach somebody for lying. I don't think there's ever been an American, including George Washington, that didn't tell a bunch of lies. I was impressed by Dostoevsky's book, The Idiot, in which Natasha, who's the heroine of the book, tells Prince Myshkin, "You always tell the truth and are therefore unjust." And I've wrestled with that concept for a long time. You don't have to tell somebody that you think they're ugly, you know, just because you think they are. You don't have to go around hurting people's feelings. You don't have to be unjust. But the idea that it's more wrongful to lie about a war of aggression, which causes hundreds of thousands of very cruel deaths, than it is to commit a war of aggression, is something I'll never understand. The war of aggression is a supreme international crime, as defined by the Nuremberg Judgment, page 12. We ought to read that judgment from time to time. It talks about a lot of wars of aggression. 21 as it counted them, beginning with the invasion of Poland. September of 39, if we don't recognize that we've been intervening forever. There's a terrible piece in the New York Times Magazine Sunday that I don't read the magazine very often because it's not a very good magazine, but there was a piece in there by David Reif, which I disagreed with totally, and it was very important because the title was, "Don't think there won't be interventions, whatever political party's in power." And then he observed the obvious. That all the American interventions, Democrat and Republican, have intervened militarily, culturally, economically, and otherwise. We have to change things fundamentally. And the sadder fact is that, you know, Bush could have lied his head off, and I happen to think he probably did. And I think the probability is very high. Like almost 100% maybe. But all the lies couldn't have made any difference if we'd only paid attention, you know? If we'd only thought. Who could have believed that Iraq was a threat? Don't we know what we did to Iraq in 1991? We hit them in 42 days with 88,000 aerial sorties. That's one every 30 seconds if you spread them out equally, night and day. 88,500 tons of bombs, the equivalent of 7.5 Hiroshimas. destroying life support systems throughout the country and life throughout the country, deliberately, defenseless people. I mean, how could they defend themselves? What could they do? We claim we destroyed 80% of their military capacity. The UN claimed to have eliminated 90% of any capacity to create weapons of mass destruction through its inspections. That leaves you about 2%, doesn't it? If you take 90% of 20%, it only leaves 10% of 20%, and that's 2%. But during that long period from Hiroshima Day, August the 7th of 1990, when the sanctions went on, until 18th of March 2003, when the sanctions went off, that is when we invaded, we killed, as Sarah reported earlier, more than 1.5 million people. Genocide. Genocide by sanctions. As if there's not enough poverty, enough hunger, enough sickness on the earth, we deliberately manufactured it in the most effective way we knew how. And who dies from sanctions? Those with the greatest needs. And who have the greatest needs? Infants, elderly. 1.5 million were children under the age of 5. Unbelievable, isn't it? And those are the only ones that died, you know. The rest didn't fare so well either. It wasn't just 750,000 dying, everybody else living happily ever after. Malnutrition was staggering. By 2002, the last report we got from the Minister of Health, and their accurate reports, 24%+ of the infants born live in Iraq during that whole year had a birth weight below 2 kilos, which means they would struggle to live. They'd be small. They'd probably have some organ damage. It might be the liver and it might be the brain. And they'd have a short life. A stunted generation, British doctors first called it in 93, just 2 years into the sanctions. This is a danger. The most galling thing is we attack Iraq claiming falsely that they had weapons of mass destruction. Possession of weapons of mass destruction is no crime. We have them, more than everybody else put together. At the very time we attack them, claiming they're planning or may have, or may soon have, weapons of mass destruction, we are planning a new generation of nuclear weapons, the most powerful weapon of mass destruction. At the very time now, we're threatening Iran. We are well along on the development of 3 new tactical nuclear weapons, a violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, among other things, and we're condemning them for trying to have, they say, nuclear energy. Why doesn't anyone point that out? We threaten them when we have more nuclear weapons than anybody else, a far more effective delivery system. I mean, if you've got to carry it in your pocket, you can't go very far, can you? And imagine what it would mean if Iran tried to attack somebody with a nuclear weapon. We'd incinerate the country, wouldn't we? Is it possible they don't understand that? You know, we can hit them with Trident II nuclear submarines from the Pacific, from the Atlantic, from the Indian Ocean, and just rain hell down on their society. They know that. The reason these small countries want a nuclear weapon is they think it may be the one way that they can prevent a military invasion of their society, because you can't risk it. I frankly doubt that they're doing it. I remember very well during the Iranian Revolution that I met with the Atomic Energy Commission there one day. About 700 guys that had PhDs in nuclear science, because the Shah was big on sending people out of the country to learn all kinds of things, and he was very keen on developing nuclear energy as a replacement for the oil when the oil ran out, so you could live happily ever after with plenty of energy. You wouldn't have to worry about the lights going out. And they were absolutely crazy. I didn't see a single group of 700 people all the time I spent in Iran in the late 70s more angry at what had been done to them, because they'd been sent out and they'd worked hard at a meaningless thing and come back and there was nothing to do. And the Shah would take a map and say, we'll put one plant here and one here and one here, and none of it made any sense, because you couldn't run a plant there. You didn't have a cooling system potential there and all the rest. You were just being frivolous with their lives. But the idea that we would threaten Iran, you think we've been rough on Iraq? Mossadegh was democratically elected. Iran was on the move. The United States overthrew Mossadegh, replaced him with the Shah, who was a kid. 25 years later, when the Shah fled, he killed as many as he dared in 1977, his last year in the country. I spent 2 or 3 months there. 43,000. 2000 Jolly Square on Black Friday in August, where U.S.-made Huey helicopters assembled, however, in Esfahan, fired 50 caliber machine guns from open bays at crowds that had gathered wearing burial shrouds because they thought they might be killed, and just mowed down 2,000 people and killed them like that. And then he saw that the people were up and they weren't going to stop. They'd been out on the streets in the millions every weekend for 3 months. In the cold of the winter, they were out on the streets. They stopped everything. The schools stopped. The factories stopped. The offices stopped. The Atomic Energy Commission stopped. Everything stopped. And the Shah fled. Colby said the proudest achievement of the CIA after this was restoring the Shah to his throne, because for 25 years, we controlled that region. He was our surrogate, our economic surrogate, our military surrogate. He even helped finance our militarism. He bought $27 billion of arms between 1972 and 1976. Three whole new weapon systems were authorized by the Congress because of billions of dollars he put into each one of them in advance orders. That's the way we've been going. The 25 years of suffering of the Iraqi people, followed by the Iran-Iraq war. We sided with Iraq in the Iran-Iraq war. Our anger with the Iranian people was still so great because they had driven us out of the country. They had destroyed our comfortable and profitable and safe base there. It served for nothing except more misery. Coming out of 25 years of misery like that's not easy. The Iran-Iraq war, Kissinger said at the beginning, "I hope they kill each other." What he really was saying is our plan that they kill each other. What could be better? If they'd kill each other now, we'd live happily ever after, wouldn't we? At least that's what our policymakers would think. But they can't get them to kill each other. Fortunately, I don't think we have the military capacity to go into Iran. I think we do have many people in our government who would gladly send Tomahawk cruise missiles toward all those nuclear plants and take them out, as we took out the pharmaceutical plant in Khartoum in Sudan that produced the majority of all the pharmaceuticals available for the country. It was the flagship of their whole healthcare system. Of all the targets we could have taken, there's not one that would have done more damage to the people than destroying that pharmaceutical plant. It produced 85% of the medicines for malaria, which is the largest cause of death in Sudan, and they couldn't replace it. It also gave 20% of all of its production to other countries, Pakistan and basically Muslim countries. That's why we took it out. We can't go on like that. We really have to change. We kill, we murder, we assassinate, we torture. New book out on Lansdale. General Lansdale's well worth reading. He's almost the sum of all the ugly American qualities. They've done so much havoc. He's starting with the Philippines and later in Vietnam, a general transferring to the CIA and doing undercover work that changes things. And we've known about it. You know, I get upset about wiretapping. I opposed all wiretapping while I was Attorney General. People don't remember this. I opposed all wiretapping and tried to close it down. But let me tell you, in my opinion, there's not a major police department in the United States, one with more than, say, 200 officers that doesn't wiretap illegally. How many federal agencies there are that wiretap illegally? I knew when I put the ban on that the suicide tap rule would go into effect. The director would say, "Can't wiretap." The associate director would say, "If you wiretap, it's your neck." Don't get caught, in other words. But we need some information or whatever we want to call it. We can't be distracted from the main issue. In all of the dialogue on impeachment now, you don't find anyone except the IAC and me, I guess, and those that support our position on impeachment. They talk about impeachment for a war of aggression. Why? Why wouldn't you impeach for the supreme international crime? Because you're afraid. You think you may need to do it again. You don't know when. Your leadership intends to do it again. We talk about regime change. The whole business in Iraq going on now is a regime change. If you look at the so-called elected leaders, they were all exiles, literally. They were all on the CIA payroll at one time or another, literally. A number of them engaged in what we would call terrorist activities, in subsidizing or directing or planning or even participating in bombing schools, bombing movie theaters. That's a fact. And we call it democracy and a new government. The trial. I love the people who suffered. I always look for the people who suffered. That's why the Romani are so important to me. I don't know of any people who have been driven more and mistreated more in more places over more years than the gypsies. And yet, who can sing like the gypsies, and who can laugh like the gypsies, and dance like the gypsies, and cheat at cards like the gypsies, you know? They're wonderful. The Kurds, a great culture. They've got their own language. They've never had their own country. I've represented the Palestinians since the 70s here in the United States. Let me tell you, there are a lot more Kurds than there are Palestinians. And the Kurds have had a lot rougher time. The Kurds in Turkey couldn't speak their own language. We went into hearings for the war crimes tribunal. Places like Diyarbakir and Cizre had a big meeting in Diyarbakir. It was a bad mistake, where about 600 men and no women in a place that just haunted the places. And speaking in Kurdish, which was a crime, and three people got killed for that. Two of the leaders were assassinated in a couple of days. The persecution, just intense, the summary execution and all the rest. We have to stand up for those who have suffered. We have to recognize the great failure in Vietnam, our common humanity. One of the great puzzles to me about how Lyndon Johnson, who couldn't stand to see Mexican-American schoolchildren come to his first classes when he finished college at San Marcos State College, barefoot. And in the Oval Office, when he described it, he'd still cry about it. Who was authentically committed in a way that no other public leader in my life has been, to civil rights. I'll never forget the farewell meeting at the end of his presidency that the Big Five, as they called them in those days, NAA and Martin Luther King, everybody was there. And the audience was 97% African-American. And everybody was crying because they could feel in his bones that he really cared. He really wanted to change things. He felt the same way about poverty. Yet in Vietnam, he could say another coonskin on the wall. He would take comfort from the body count. If the body count of Vietnamese reported killed the prior day was high, he'd be in a good mood, literally. It's a good day to ask for an extra appropriation or whatever you needed. If we lost a bunch of planes, stay away. He'd be very upset. I had a long conversation once with Saddam Hussein, and we started out about how Johnson had started out in rural electrification. Said if you bring electricity to the farmer, he'll never forget you. But it changes everything in his life. And Saddam Hussein said, I started in rural electrification. So I had that same experience. And then he asked me, what do you think about him in the Vietnam War? Explain this seeming schizophrenia. Well, he would love the Mexican-American children. He would love the African-Americans. And he couldn't recognize the humanity of the Vietnamese. And Saddam Hussein, through his translator, said, we have a saying that a prophet is a person who can love at a distance. And I thought that was quite an amazing observation. Anybody can love the little kids right here playing around them, you know, and think nothing of destroying 750,000 Iraqi children. They don't see them. They can't love at a distance. You take care of your own, and the devil take the hindmost. We have to have priorities. I think closing down recruitment centers is of great importance. If you want to go for the jugular, and I've been saying this for so many years, it's hard to seem that it's meaningful to say it anymore. You've got to slash the military budget. There's no other way. We spend more on arms than all other countries combined. What's the meaning of that? One meeting is pretty obvious. It's what Madeleine Albright said to Colin Powell when he was reluctant to use military force in a particular situation. She said, why do you have all these arms and men if you're not going to use them? You don't manufacture them not to use them. And the coercion that comes from their threat actually exceeds their actual use. The damage that comes from just selling them and giving them to surrogates around the world exceeds the damage that comes from it. If we can't come to grips with our military budget, we'll remain a military threat to the world. Including ourselves. You know, it's been, what, 39 years since Dr. King gave his Riverside Church speech. It's been longer than he lived. He died in his 38th year. It was 1967. It was actually 1 year exactly before he was assassinated. And he said, the greatest purveyor of violence on earth is my own government. And it was the hardest. He said so. He sent me a copy of the speech, and I still have it. I treasure it. It was a great speech. He says, the hardest statement he ever made, because he was afraid it would destroy the civil rights movement. Civil rights leaders were saying, hey, it's tough enough being black in this society, you know. You want to be black and a traitor, too? You know, we've got to go along to get along. And he couldn't buy that. There was an article in the paper yesterday about how civil rights leaders were afraid to stand up like Dr. King did and condemn this war as he condemned the war in Vietnam. But that's why we have to be not afraid and stand up when we see something that we know is right. We can stop recruiting, and that'll be very important because they're having a hard time recruiting already. Well, I think it's a sensitive point and should be tried. But let's not forget for a minute the big picture. And let's not forget Jonathan Swift's Gulliver's Travels. Well, finally, there were so many little strings tying Gulliver down that he couldn't rise up. Gulliver was a person of goodwill and good intentions. But you can't find a congressional district in the United States that doesn't have as its major employer a military base or a military contractor. And you can find the biggest and best peace activists in the Congress, and they'll be against all the other appropriations, but not for their district. And finally, we got to come home and say, stop it. Because it will continue. Even if we pull back from Iraq, there'll be another one. There may be another one before we have a chance to pull back from Iraq. And that's why we have to do the final thing. And a failure to do that will not only be the ultimate failure of the American Constitution, but it will be the last best hope we have to redeem ourselves in the eyes of the world, which see us as a people that, however inherently decent, haven't had the courage or the will to stand up to their own government and say, stop. Right. The next president may not be as wild as Bush. He's the wildest that we've had, I think. But he's just doing in extremis what others have done in a more cautious way. Unless we do this thing, the next president will do what the last president did. No more interventions. It's a supreme international crime. And you will be impeached, just as George W. Bush was impeached, if you commit a war of aggression. That has to be the keystone to the impeachment movement, because it's the single greatest offense that he's committed and that has to be stopped. If we do that, we may recapture the country. We're going to have a radical change in the composition of the government. We really are. I mean, the Congress today is owned by wealth. We are a plutocracy, as Aristotle described it. Government by wealth. This is election year for every member of the House of Representatives. The House of Representatives has the sole power of impeachment under the Constitution. And we have to go to every congressional district and say, change your position, or we the people will change you. And if we can't organize that and do that, en masse. We want to know where you stand on impeachment now. We want them to look at the total array of impeachment issues, but we don't want them to be marginal things, like whether you misled or whether you deceived. In the first place, you'll never convince everybody about what someone believed, but what they did, you can convince them about. No one can deny that we assaulted Iraq when it was absolutely no potential threat to us, even if it had weapons of mass destruction. So I hope we'll organize on priorities. I hope we'll think clearly. I hope we'll understand the enormity and duration of the misery we've caused. There's been a major regime change, overt, bodacious, since that in Iraq. And it's in a country that we ought to love more than any in the hemisphere because it's the poorest, Haiti. George Bush said, Aristide has to go. How do you like that? A guy who's elected illegally to the presidency of the United States says a guy who's elected by a majority of more than 60% and who has the faith and confidence of the poor people of Haiti, which is the great majority, absolutely, has to go. And he went. And you can't imagine the misery that the Haitian people have suffered since then. Not that it was a picnic before, because since their successful slave rebellion, they've had few good days, much less years. And Aristide was determined to change that. Read his books, Eyes of the Heart. Read his speech at the United Nations, that brief time in September of 91 when he was president, the week before he was deposed. Remember, when he was deposed, we thought he would be killed while an Air Force plane escorted baby Doc Duvalier from Haiti, and he's still living on the backs of the Haitian people in the French Riviera. We all remember that it was a great Democrat, Woodrow Wilson, who caused the initial invasion of Haiti. Not the initial, but the main one, 1915. Franklin Roosevelt sitting as Assistant Secretary of State on a destroyer deck, bobbing in the rough surf in the Windward Passage between Cuba and Guantanamo and Cap Haitien. Claimed to have written the Constitution for the people of Haiti. What an outrageous thing to claim, you know. Toussaint Louverture wrote a constitution that suited the people just fine before he was killed. I have to add, that's exactly what we're doing in Iraq right now. We write their constitution. It comes out in English and then it's translated. We write the description for the court. We appoint the judges. We tell them what to do. It's a puppet show. Pathetic. Designed, ultimately, if they can just get away with it, to make it appear that the Iraqi people demanded that their former leadership be executed and quick, in cold blood, irreconcilably dividing the country, if it's not already irreconcilably divided, and headed toward civil war. No more interventions, no more exploitation of poor people at home or abroad. Impeachment for high crimes and misdemeanors, fearlessly and fairly. And that'll mean most of the leadership in the military area, the president, the vice president, the secretary of defense, and a dozen others in this administration that have to be impeached for their conduct. And then realize that every day we have to keep working. One of the saddest days that I've experienced, because I was old enough then, was the day we had the big rally in Central Park saying the war was over. The war in Vietnam. The war wasn't over. It was 1975. We thought we were going to get a peace dividend. That's what we really wanted, more than having the war over, apparently. Sanctions were imposed on Vietnam, but people paid no attention. And the Vietnamese people suffered more from 1975 to 1995 when the sanctions went off than they did from 1945 when they started their war with the French until 1975 when they drove the United States off the roof of the embassy in Saigon. The war will be over when the people are committed relentlessly to seeing that there is never another war of aggression by the United States of America.